Today on the 21st Show, a conversation with Colleen Shogan, a former archivist of the United States, the person responsible for safeguarding federal records. It's traditionally been a nonpartisan post, but Shogan was one of the first high-profile officials fired by President Trump.
You know, I had never been fired from a job in my entire life, and I've been working since I was 16 years old. So, I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that the first job you ever get fired from is by the President of the United States, you know, in public, where the next day you wake up and you're on, you know, you're on CNN.
I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we begin today with a pop quiz. Can you name the first archivist of the United States? How about the second, or third, or fourth, through tenth, or any of the other officials who filled in on the role until a permanent successor was confirmed by the Senate? I would wager most Americans, including me, could not name a single previous archivist of the United States until the last few years.
Colleen Shogan made history when she became the first woman to serve as archivist of the United States in 2023.
Last September, we went inside the National Archives with Colleen Shogan, the chief archivist of the United States.
Have you been thinking about the National Archive? Because maybe you should. It is one of the most independent, non-political agencies within the federal government.
Colleen Shogan was fired last night. The National Archives was the location where Trump allegedly removed more than 300 classified documents in 2021.
No cause was given for her dismissal.
When President Trump was elected again, the Justice Department started firing anybody who worked on the Trump investigation. And now that includes the head of the National Archives, even though she wasn't even there when the Trump investigation happened.
Colleen Shogan was appointed to the role by President Joe Biden in 2022 and confirmed by the Senate the next year. She was the first woman confirmed by the Senate in the role, though three other women had served as archivist in an acting capacity for a collective total of 4 years. As you heard, Shogan is no longer the archivist, having been among the first of many nonpartisan officials fired by President Donald Trump. Back in October, I had the chance to speak with Shogan about her life, her work, and her prominent dismissal by the president. We'll be revisiting that conversation for the hour today. Since our program's on tape, no calls, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. Let's start with some basics. What is the job of the Archivist of the United States?
The Archivist of the United States is the head of the National Archives and Records Administration, which is a federal agency where the headquarters are in Washington, D.C., but actually the National Archives has locations all around the country. So just the same way as the Secretary of Commerce runs the Commerce Department, the Archivist of the United States runs the National Archives. And, you know, the National Archives is the repository for all of our nation's presidential and federal records.
What is the job like day to day?
Well, every day was a little bit different. I traveled a lot when I was Archivist of the United States because we did have about 40 different facilities and locations all across the United States. Most people think that when they come to see the National Archives in Washington, D.C., off the National Mall, that that's the only location or facility of the National Archives, but that's really the tip of the iceberg. It's where most of our visitors come because, of course, that's where the Constitution, the Declaration, the Bill of Rights are on display. But that's just really the beginning of the National Archives and Records Administration because there are facilities all across the country that hold our nation's records. And I traveled a lot to many of those different facilities when I was Archivist of the United States. So some days, I would say about a third of the time, I was actually on the road and visiting and doing public events. And the rest of the time I was in Washington, D.C. If Congress was in session, a lot of the times I spent time on Capitol Hill talking to members of Congress about the mission of the National Archives, our budget, and other matters. And if I was in the archives building, I was talking with staff, doing strategic planning, meeting with senior leaders, and also meeting with stakeholders who had an interest in the National Archives.
And the presidential libraries, I think people might be familiar with that as sort of a public-facing aspect of what you do.
Absolutely. The presidential libraries from Herbert Hoover through George W. Bush are part of the National Archives system. A lot of people don't realize that. And I visited all of the National Archives presidential libraries when I was archivist of the United States. And they do a great job in really being a repository, but also a way to share our nation's history through our presidents. So I like to use the example of the Reagan Library in California, in Southern California, because Reagan was in office, obviously, for 8 years. And really, that museum is a way in which we can share the history of the United States in the 1980s. And President Reagan is the center of that, but it really deals with all kinds of things that happened in the 1980s in the United States.
If you visited all of them, you are way ahead of me on my travel bucket list, but I've been to a few. The Johnson one was particularly striking, I thought, in Texas. So you're only the 11th Senate confirmed archivist, or were, I should say. What can you tell me about the history of the position?
Well, the National Archives and Records Administration was created under Franklin Roosevelt. That's when the legislation was actually signed. So it doesn't come into creation as an agency until the 1930s. And the building that people visit in Washington, D.C., where the Rotunda is located with the founding documents, really has an interesting history. That building was the location for that building came under Calvin Coolidge. Ground was broken for that building under Herbert Hoover, and then the building was actually finished under Franklin Roosevelt. So it took three different presidential administrations to actually get that building online and finished. And the reason why there was a decision that we had to have a National Archives and Records Administration was, of course, other democracies were doing so and were centralizing the repository for federal and governmental records. But then some people also noticed that the records were being held at various agency locations, and they were not all being held in necessarily the best conditions. And some of these records were deteriorating. So it was decided that we needed a National Archives and Records Administration as a place that would serve as the permanent repository of those records so Americans would have access to their history.
If Wikipedia is to be believed, there were three women who were tapped to serve as acting archivist in the history of that office. Why do you think no women had been nominated as the permanent holder of the role until you?
I think for the same reason why there wasn't women who served in a lot of these roles for major libraries across the United States, major museums. The National Archives would have just been part of that component until about within the past 10 years. The vast majority of people who work in the field of archives, of libraries, of museums are women. It's between anywhere between 80 and even upwards of 80% of the people who actually work in that field. But there were very few women that actually led institutions across the United States, certainly not federal institutions, but even major institutions across the United States in this area. And that started to change, I would say, you know, within the past decade. So I think that was really the reason, was that even though women dominated the field, numerically, they just weren't viewed as candidates for actually leading the institutions.
I wonder what your family's reaction was to hearing the news of your appointment.
Well, I told my brother and my father when it was certain that I was going to get the nomination, but it wasn't public yet. And the White House said that I could share the news with just, you know, the small number of family members. My husband obviously knew because I had been going through the process the whole time. But my dad was almost, I think he was 88 or 89 years old. And I told him and my brother in person. And when I explained it to my dad, who had never visited the National Archives, when I explained it to my dad, he was just so astounded by it. And my husband tried to explain it by saying, you know, President Biden is going to nominate her because he thinks that she's the best person in the country, really, to do this job. And I mean, my dad was, I think, almost moved to tears by the news. It was I will remember that actual moment. And I don't think I've ever talked about it. So thank you for the question.
Maybe we can step back. You mentioned your father and your brother. You grew up in the Pittsburgh area. What was your childhood like? Was archival work destined from a young age?
No, certainly not. Although I will say my dad worked as a draftsman and as an engineering designer at Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, and then eventually at a smaller company called CSE Corporation, where he worked on mining equipment. My brother is a mechanical engineer. My mother worked in teletype in Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, before she was a homemaker. And no, there was no archival or library science anywhere in my family, although my dad was a fan of history, a fan of American history in particular. So when we would go on family vacations, which usually were family vacations within driving distance of Pittsburgh, you know, we would always go to places where kids would enjoy, you know, like Hershey Park or Busch Gardens. But he would also insist that we would do something that was historical in nature as well, whether it was visiting Yorktown or visiting the battlefields at Gettysburg. And so I grew up actually visiting a fair number of historical sites in the area of greater Pittsburgh. And I think that was one of the things that helped spark my interest in history by seeing it right in front of me in my own backyard.
What are your earliest memories, I'm curious, of reading? Is that something you always enjoyed?
Yes. I mean, my mother was a great reader. She loved to read, and we would have time together in which we would simply spend time reading together. And she would be reading her book, you know, and I would be reading my book. So it was when I was old enough to be able to read independently and on my own. And I really credit her with my great love of reading and reading widely in all kinds of different areas. She was also a great fan of mysteries. And so I inherited my love of mysteries from my mother and really was at an early age as well.
I understand you're a first generation college student. Talk about what that meant to you and your family.
Yes, I am. My brother and I are first generation college students. And it was something that my parents really insisted upon. They were great. Neither of them had went to college. My dad went to a college briefly at Pitt before he left to join the military, to join the Army. And he served in Germany after World War II. So the occupation of Germany by the United States and the Allied forces. And, you know, he did not finish college. My mother never attended, but they saw the great value in education. So even as a young girl, it was emphasized to me how important it was that I go to college, that I get a college education. My brother is 12 years older than me, so he went ahead of me to college. He went to West Virginia University, and so we would travel to visit him at WVU with some frequency. So I got exposure to a college campus, what a university is like, and that was helpful as well. But my parents were great fans of education and how it can actually change people's lives.
So you go to Boston College, bachelor's in political science. You go on to a PhD from Yale in American politics. What did you envision? What path did you sort of have in mind for your life back then?
Well, I certainly thought when I went to graduate school that I loved studying American politics. I loved studying the history of political thought and political philosophy. I really thought that I would get a PhD and then hopefully get a position at a university, hopefully a university that had some research components to it, and that likely I would stay at that university for the remainder of my career, and I would teach American politics and do research in American politics, which is what I love doing and what I had actually been trained to do.
So you're an assistant professor at George Mason University. What was teaching Correct. Like?
Yeah, I taught the classes that I was really trained to teach. Intro to American politics. I taught the presidency. I taught a graduate seminar on the presidency in Congress. You know, and George Mason is a terrific school. And certainly when I was there in the you know, early 2000s, it was a school that was up and coming and on the rise right outside the D.C. area. It was a very exciting time to be there.
You had a book, The Moral Rhetoric of American Presidents. I wonder, and we can get into the current administration later on, but this was a number of years ago. You know, what do you think of the moral rhetoric of American presidents in the present age? What are some takeaways from that work that might relate to what we're experiencing now? Yeah.
And I haven't really, you know, returned to that specific, you know, research project in a long time, but I mean, the idea of that project was that there is a moral dimension to presidential leadership. And one way in which presidents can exercise that moral leadership is through how they communicate it, through their speech. And that many times over American history, we see historical cases of presidents that used that ability to be able to use that rhetorical lens in order to enhance their leadership to great strategic and political advantage. And that's really what the book was about.
All right, we need to take a break. We are hearing from Colleen Shogan, former archivist of the United States. I originally spoke with her back in October. Because our program's on tape today, we're not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Colleen Shogan. She was the 11th archivist of the United States until she was dismissed by President Trump last year. Again, I originally spoke with her back in October. Because of that, no calls today, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. As we continue through the course of your career, I'm always curious about people in these top roles. Like, what is the path? How someone gets from where they were to where they are or were. So you spent some time at the Library of Congress, Assistant Deputy for Collections, Deputy Director of the Congressional Research Service. Sounds like a dream job for a certain kind of politics nerd. How did that come about?
Sure. I mean, one of the big things that was pivotal in my career was that I was at George Mason and I started teaching, you know, undergraduate students, but then also graduate students who were a little bit older. And I realized that there was a major hole in my education. I had been, you know, beneficiary of great formal education at Boston College and Yale. But I had never actually worked in American politics. I had never worked on Capitol Hill. I hadn't worked at the White House. I hadn't worked at a federal agency. And I was surrounded by people that had, either as interns or, you know, they had graduated from college and they had spent time working at these jobs. And there was a little bit of a disconnect between what I was teaching and what these students were experiencing. So I knew there was a remedy for this, and that was the American Political Science Association Congressional Fellowship. And I knew about the fellowship quite well because one of my dissertation advisors at Yale, David Mayhew, who studies Congress, he had written his first book because of his congressional fellowship that he had had. So I decided to apply for the fellowship. I got it. And I took a year off of George Mason to go work on Capitol Hill. And that really changed my entire professional life, my entire trajectory, because I worked in the Senate, I worked for Senator Lieberman, and I really became interested in public service as a different career path for myself. And after my fellowship was over, Senator Lieberman asked me to stay on. He offered me a full-time position in his office, and I decided to leave academia and do it because I knew there would never be another opportunity like that one to take that path for public service and public leadership. And I did it. I stayed there for a few more years, and then I ended up at the Library of Congress at the Congressional Research Service after that. And that was a dream job for someone who likes studying institutions, who likes politics, who likes Congress, because not only before when I was with Senator Lieberman, I got to understand how one office worked. And that was illuminating to me at the time. But when I worked at CRS, we would work for members on both sides of the aisle. We worked for House members, we worked for senators, we worked for committee staff, we worked for personal office staff, leadership staff, and I really started to understand the institution in a much broader way as a political scientist. So those were really exciting years that I spent at CRS.
Do you think is that a broader critique you'd make of political science, sort of academic political science disconnection from practical politics as it's done in America?
I think in general, sometimes whenever I read research, sometimes there's particularly people that study certain institutions. If you don't understand how those institutions actually operate on the ground, you can make decisions about data sets, for example, that don't really line up to how that phenomenon actually transpires in real life. So there, it might be a lot more complicated than what you're actually imagining it, which would then sort of make any conclusions that you're drawing from that data perhaps not as sound as what you would want them to be. So, I think I come from a background, at a place like Yale where public service was actually emphasized. And so I think the idea of academics, particularly academics that study American politics, going in and out of public service and then coming back through academia and circulating through is a very good model, actually.
So you mentioned the process toward the nomination from President Biden to be the archivist of the U.S. I'm curious how these things come about. Was there a job posting on the bulletin board at the White House Historical Association? Did somebody call you out of the blue? How does this work?
No, there's really not job postings per se, although, the White House Office of Presidential Personnel does take people's resumes and will consider you for a whole variety of positions that are available, because there's many that are available across the federal government. So that path is always open. But, you were correct in saying that at that point in time, I was working at the White House Historical Association, which is not a government agency. It's actually a nonpartisan nonprofit that works alongside the White House for its preservation and also sharing the history of the White House and the people who lived and worked there. And, I basically got on a radar for the position because they were open to considering people that might be qualified for the role. And they were very aware, the Biden administration, that this job was different than other positions that they had recruited people for, that this job was a nonpartisan job, even though President Biden, you would go through the political nomination process that explicitly in the statute that the person should not be selected for any political reasons, but because of their qualifications. It's a long process to go through something like this with the White House because there's numerous interviews. There's a lot of paperwork that you have to do. You have to be willing to be transparent about your entire life. That's what I would say. Your finances, all of your previous employment, your relationships, your friendships, All of those things are going to be asked about when you go through the vetting process for a White House nomination where you're actually running a federal agency.
And so you go through this vetting process. 5 days after you're nominated, though, the FBI raids Mar-a-Lago, where former and future President Donald Trump is alleged to have improperly stored boxes of documents from his first term. And obviously, this becomes the basis for one of the criminal prosecutions of then-former President Trump for improper handling of classified documents. I'm trying to remember the timeline of what was publicly known about this case. Did you have any idea what was going to be happening and how the National Archives would be figuring into this, what would become a huge national story?
Absolutely not. I had no idea. And no one ever shared that with me when I was interviewing for the position or going through the vetting process. I was sitting on my couch. It was the evening, and I was working on my computer, as I almost always do in the evening. And one of those alerts comes across your screen, like from CNN or one of the major networks. And it said that the FBI had secured a search warrant for President Trump's home for classified records that were allegedly there. And I was shocked. So, and I knew, I'm a political scientist, so I knew this was going to affect my nomination and the consideration of my nomination.
And indeed, it did become sort of a discussion point in the hearings. And I don't know if you want to talk about the specifics of that case, but I wonder if you can speak at least generally. You're welcome to talk about the specifics of the case, but at least speak generally to what happens with presidential records and what NARA, the National Archives and Records Administration, does with them after a presidency.
Sure. Yeah, I was never involved with that case, with the classified records case. So I'll just make that clear. Not when I was the nominee to become the archivist, and not even when I was the archivist of the United States, because that was being handled by the Department of Justice. I had no involvement in it, and I wasn't at the National Archives when any of these things transpired. So I was not considered to be someone that would be a witness or someone that would be involved in it. So there was a firewall that was put up between me and that case, and I never had a briefing on it or never spent any time, certainly with the Department of Justice, about it. But yes, presidential records. There's a difference between presidential records and federal records. That's the first thing to understand. It's just a basic difference. Federal records are records that are produced in the execution of the duties of any federal agency. And about 1-3% of all the records that are produced in a federal agency are actually kept for permanent retention by the National Archives. So most of those records, the vast majority of those records, are temporary records that would be retained for a certain period of time by the agency, but they never are accessioned into the National Archives or its collection.
So a park ranger writes up a report about a bear breaking into a car at Yosemite, not going to be preserved for future generations, probably.
Probably not. Yeah. I mean, probably not. I don't know exactly on that instance, but I mean,
most likely not.
You know, a decision memo, though, by, one of the senior leaders at the National Park Service about bears that are, you know, causing problems in national parks across the country. Now, that probably would become a permanent record at the National Archives. But the difference between those federal records and presidential records are that all presidential records are permanent records of the National Archives. They are in the possession of the president and the White House throughout their duration of the administration, and typically ends on January 20th at noon. But then once that administration ends, then they are immediately transferred. The legal authority is immediately transferred to the National Archives and Records Administration.
And so I guess the idea here is that if they're in a bathroom that, it's someone's residence, that's problematic. Or in a garage, as we saw with President Biden as well. So how do you get to, when do you get a sense that this is could be a problem for your tenure in this role?
Well, I didn't actually, when I was, like I said, when I was the archivist of the United States, I didn't spend any time on it per se. I was very interested in presidential libraries and certainly interested in sharing presidential records. But it didn't really, I don't think it really presented itself as a intrinsic problem to my tenure, the vast majority of my tenure as archivist of the United States.
Yeah. Well, and maybe we should pause on that and talk more about that time, because I know there were you were dragged into the news on the Democratic side of the aisle as well when for example, President Biden, maybe just by way of backstory, I'll explain, the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution had been widely thought dead since actually the state of Illinois failed to ratify it in the early 1980s. But at one point, President Joe Biden declares that it's the law of the land. And I won't get into the machinations of why he, thought he could assert that. But can you talk about what happened and how you ended up having to, make a public comment on that?
Well, I mean, the Equal Rights Amendment issue, I knew that when I was the nominee, that that was going to be something that would be of public interest and concern. When I was considering accepting the nomination as Archivist of the United States, the White House explained the issue to me because there had been a Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel analysis done under the Trump administration. When President Biden came into office, they decided to have the DOJ look at the issue again. And essentially, the same memo was issued under the Biden administration. So there was consistency in the Office of Legal Counsel about how to approach the Equal Rights Amendment. So those memos and the information was shared with me when I was going through the vetting process. They knew that I would, if I was selected and I went and went forward, that I, if and I was confirmed, I would become the first woman to ever serve in this role in permanent capacity. So they knew there would be great pressure on me to consider publication or certification of the Equal Rights Amendment. So I read everything about it when I was not even before I became the nominee, because I wasn't going to accept the nomination if I thought that I couldn't actually uphold what the Department of Justice was currently saying, because that wouldn't make any sense to put myself in a position where I couldn't uphold what the Office of Legal Counsel or the Department of Justice had issued as the memo.
And
It
can you
was not.
remind me, the memo was that it's not to be ratified,
Right, it was not.
even though
Right, it was.
Illinois had come in many decades later and ratified it after the fact. Yeah.
There's no doubt that 38 states have ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, but the Equal Rights Amendment deadline expired for the second time in 1981. So that's the main concern. The other concern is that five states have rescinded their ratification since they originally ratified it. So the question of the status of rescissions is something that is, I would say, legally ambiguous at this point in time. Although in Reconstruction times, there were rescissions of ratifications of the Reconstruction amendments. And at that point in time, it was determined that those Reconstruction amendments could go forward. So there is some legal precedent for that. But the deadline was 1981. So that was the main, I would say, the main point of contention, I say legal point of contention about publication and full ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. So, I mean, I read, it was good that I had worked at CRS all those years because I was used to reading about policy issues, understanding them, and getting up to speed on them and being able to make, a determination. And when I read everything about the ERA, I understood what people who were, I guess you could say, pro-ERA advocates, I understood what they were saying, but I also thought the preponderance of the evidence was on the side of the Department of Justice and the Office of Legal Counsel. There was also a district court ruling that it said as such, which said that the Archivist of the United States could not publish the Equal Rights Amendment. And then afterwards, in 2023, after I was already in office, there was a circuit court ruling that concurred with that district court ruling. So now we have a district court unanimous ruling. We have a circuit court ruling that was likewise unanimous. And so, to me, you have the DOJ that has issued an analytical memo, which agrees with the past administration, but now you're in a new administration, and you have two court rulings at the federal level, both district and circuit, that are in concurrence of each other. So the issue for me, there was nothing I could do about it because Congress had not acted in any way to try to change the deadline, and the courts had been definitive at that point of time of what the state of play was.
All right, we need to take another break. We'll have more with the former Archivist of the United States, Colleen Shogan, when we return. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to my conversation from October with Colleen Shogan. She is a former archivist of the United States, only the 11th person to permanently hold that role, actually. She was also the first woman permanently in the job, though others had previously served in an acting capacity. Shogan was dismissed last year by President Trump, becoming one of many nonpartisan officials who've been fired by the administration. I should note, when I spoke to her, Shogan was about to come to Illinois to be one of two keynote speakers at the annual Lincoln Legacy Lecture in Springfield. Obviously, that event has passed, but we're leaving in a few questions I asked her about that because they do shed more light on her work. Again, because today's conversation was recorded last year, we're not taking calls, but you can let us know what you thought. talk@21stshow.org. One of the other things that came up during your time as archivist is the Wall Street Journal had a piece that said you and some of your advisors were de-emphasizing negative parts of history in some upcoming exhibitions. I mean, I do think that there are, you know, this is something on which reasonable people disagree about striking a balance in how you present American history. I wonder if you can speak about that and how you were thinking about that during your time in that role of, you know, again, preserving the Declaration of Independence and not just preserving it and our other founding documents, but, you know, keeping them alive and in consciousness for future generations.
Absolutely. I mean, I completely disagree with the characterization that was in the Wall Street Journal. I've spoken previously, actually, to National Public Radio about this and gave an interview several weeks after the Wall Street Journal article was published. But in general, what I would say is I took my role as Archivist of the United States as a nonpartisan leader of that agency very, very seriously. I promised under oath that I would in front of the Senate when I went through the confirmation process. But I had also worked at the Library of Congress for many years, also a nonpartisan agency, and at the White House Historical Association, which is not an agency, a nonprofit, but is also likewise nonpartisan in its approach. So I had been around how to operate in a nonpartisan sphere for many, many years before I came to the National Archives. I had also witnessed many exhibits at the Library of Congress during my tenure at the Library of Congress. So I understood intrinsically the approach that we needed to take at the National Archives. The National Archives should not be presenting history in any way that is ideological or takes a particular stance on the interpretation of history. And that means that could be an interpretation that would be considered more left of center or an interpretation that would be considered more conservative or right of center. That is not the role of the National Archives. And I drew a bright line in the sand with how we exhibited ourselves, how we engaged in public displays, and how we talked about the National Archives, that we were going to do so in a nonpartisan way. And I was emphatic about it. And I stand by my decisions for sure.
Is it possible to continue to have, or for these roles, there, you know, it is the ethos of people to be nonpartisan, right? The archivist, the Library of Congress, Congressional Research Service, we can go down the line, there are state institutions that are comparable to that. In an era where all the partisans want to know which side you're on, right? How do you navigate that? How does somebody in a role like that navigate that?
I mean, it's a great question. It was very, very challenging. It was very difficult. I used to say, it's not, these positions are not for people who have the faint of heart, because at some point or the other, if you are actually doing your job in a nonpartisan fashion, in one of these roles, both parties at different times, most likely, both parties at different times are going to become upset and frustrated with you. And they're going to try to attack you or question your approach. So you have to be very, very self-centered and very certain in your own leadership and what you're doing, so that when these questions come from either side of the aisle, that you aren't tempted to waver or change your approach in any way. But I am a firm believer that these institutions, like the Library of Congress, the Archives, the Smithsonian, they must remain nonpartisan, because if they do not remain nonpartisan, if they become politicized, then we are going to lose trust in these institutions. And we have to have public trust in the institutions that are preserving our nation's history, our nation's artifacts, our nation's knowledge, and of course, our records.
Well, public trust is the thing we've probably lost most in this country, in institutions in recent years. So the president goes on a radio interview January 6th of this year and says that, yeah, the archivist is going to have to go. Is that the first that you had a sense that you would be dragged into the sort of president's, I don't know how you want to characterize it, vengeance campaign against, maybe that's putting it too harshly, but I don't know. I'll let you characterize how that came.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had, at that point in time, there had been a whole transition process. I had worked very effectively in the past. I had started at the White House Historical Association when President Trump was in office for the first time, worked alongside the First Lady, Mrs. Trump, on a number of initiatives. We had known each other and had actually been, discussing about how she might want to work with the National Archives in the future and planning for 2026, the 250th anniversary of the United States. So I certainly felt like that I, even though things had happened in the past, I had nothing to do with those decisions that were made. I had certainly acted in a professional and nonpartisan fashion during my tenure.
So maybe we should say to listeners, it is a position that has in multiple instances in the past spanned different changes of party in the White House,
that's
right?
Correct. Yeah. And I'm the first woman to ever be in the role, but I'm also the only person who has ever been removed by a president in the role. That's never happened before in American history. I also think in that interview, if you listen to it, I don't think President Trump was angling to say that he wanted to remove me. This was under a number of prodding from Hugh Hewitt.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, then, of course, we went and tried to figure out, if there was what had happened and why he would necessarily say that, because there would not been any concerns or problems up to that point. We didn't have a transition team at the National Archives. And, everything that all the indications that we had gotten was that it was full steam ahead and continue to do the job that you're doing and in the fashion in which you're doing it. So, of course, we tried to circle back and try to get some reassurances. And I think, at that point in time, we did, hey, just keep planning for the future. You're doing a good job and go forward. So, I proceeded to do so.
I read you had posted on LinkedIn, I think that night when you were finally dismissed in February, that you were given no reason. Do you still have any sense of as to what was behind that?
I do not. And I was never told why I was dismissed as archivist of the United States. And the White House has never said anything about it.
Remarkable. I wonder how that sits with you. How you've processed that. I can only imagine it was a pretty difficult. It was difficult to lose a job at all. Super difficult to do so in such a public way. I would imagine that adds a dimension to it.
Absolutely. You know, I had never been fired from a job in my entire life, and I've been working since I was 16 years old. So, I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that you're the first job you ever get fired from is by the President of the United States, you know, in public, where the next day you wake up and you're on, you know, you're on CNN. I don't necessarily recommend it to anyone. It wasn't a particularly fun time. But when I had time to be able to reflect and think about things, I'm very proud of my public service. I'm proud of the decisions that I made as Archivist of the United States. I hope that I strengthened the institution. Would I had liked to had more time in the role? Absolutely, because I think there's a lot of things that have to be done at the National Archives. But once again, it goes back to the fact that if you're in these roles, you have to have a pretty tough skin and you have to be incredibly self-possessed. And I am. I'm self-possessed as far as knowing what was right, what was wrong, what I would do. And I followed the law in all instances and made sure that I followed the law when I was acting as archivist. So I am proud of my service and I look forward to the
What
future.
do you see as your role in public life now?
Well, I work for a terrific organization called More Perfect, which is an alliance of a number of organizations across the country. It's nonpartisan in nature, and they're interested in strengthening democracy in a number of different ways. And I work particularly for More Perfect in the area of civics education. And I think this is a major area where we need a lot of work in the United States. And this is not a partisan issue. I think it's something that Republicans and Democrats can agree upon that we need better civics education and we need to pay more attention to history and civics education for K-12 students, for college students, and for actually all Americans.
The event you're a part of in Springfield is called Lincoln and the Age of Disruption. Can you share a little bit about what you're planning to talk about?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's great. I mean, it's a great title. It was a really fun topic to be able to write a 25 or 30 minute speech about. But a lot of what I'm going to be talking about will really be what we talked about in this interview. What is the National Archives as an institution? Why is it important? Why is it an important part of a democracy? And why is it important that institutions like the National Archives that preserve our nation's history, why is it important that they remain nonpartisan institutions? And what is at risk if they're not?
Why is it important to democracy to have these documents? And maybe I should share, I recently came across a quote from Felix Frankfurter, who this was from a concurrence to a Supreme Court opinion he joined, the Supreme Court justice in 1945, where he said, "The history of American freedom is, in no small measure, the history of procedure." And he hearkened all the way back to the Magna Carta, which I have seen at the National Archives building in Washington. Maybe you can talk about, the importance, why these documents, these old pieces of parchment are important for safeguarding democracy, however you want to phrase that.
Yeah, I mean, it's for at least, you know, many reasons, but when it's concerning democracy, democracy rests, whether it's, you know, democracy in a town, democracy amongst your, you know, homeowners association, democracy in any setting, and certainly the United States, democracy rests upon accountability, because we are picking people to serve in our stead and lead us in a democracy, in a representative democracy. And we have to be able to hold our representatives in a republic and hold our government in general accountable. The only way that we are able to do that is through transparency. And the main way in which we do that at the federal level in the United States is through the records that are preserved at the National Archives. That changes how we think about our democracy, about various episodes, but it also changes, it can change how we think about our history and what we learn from our history. And it's very important that we do that so that it can inform our present and it can also inform our future.
Colleen Shogan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, thank you.
Colleen Shogan was the 11th Archivist of the United States. She's also involved with a number of civic organizations, senior advisor at the group More Perfect, and she's a civics fellow at the group Stand Together. She also recently became a member of the board of directors at the United States Capitol Historical Society. And one more time, we originally spoke with Shogan in October, shortly before she came to the University of Illinois Springfield for the annual Lincoln Legacy Lecture. That's it for us today. Before we go, I want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. You can do so by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can find that information and every other way to contact us, including our voicemail line, on our website, which is 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. We've got our past programs there and links to subscribe to our podcasts, or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.